Okay, so now we're going to talk about graphical interaction. And as I said yesterday, graphical interaction is the thing that is most well known because that's what everybody uses these days. So graphical user interfaces, also called GUIs, GUIs. And in the course today, I will talk about, get back to direct manipulation, which we introduced yesterday. Talk briefly about state machines, which you will use in the TA sessions next week. Then spend some time on the basic interaction techniques that are used in today's interfaces. Talk a bit about the notion of mode, and then show a number of novel graphical interaction techniques that you may not know to show you the type of research that is done in this area. So I will not go through the four principles of direct manipulation, which we already saw yesterday. Objects are presented on the screen as graphical objects. The user can use physical actions that are rapid, incremental, and reversible. And the effects of these actions is immediately visible on the objects that is being manipulated. And then you have a layered approach that allows users to discover what the system can do progressively. I also skip this slide on WIMP interfaces. I introduced that yesterday. So WIMP stands for Windows, Icons, Menus, and Pointing. And so these are the basic elements of graphical user interfaces. And what is important with respect to what we discussed earlier today is the notion of feedback in those user interfaces. Because as you do things, you expect to have the system on the screen sort of behave like almost a physical system. And so you expect that when you move an object, the object actually moves. And so you expect this type of feedback as you make actions in the environment. So while the principles of direct manipulation are fairly simple to understand, they are not always well understood and well applied in existing systems. So oftentimes what you have is not direct manipulation, but really indirect manipulation. So I take this example here that is a classic case where you have an object on the screen, it's this little text, Toto, and it has these little handles around it because you have selected it, meaning I want to do something with that object. Now, if what I want to do with that object is to make it bigger, what many tools will make you do is go to, say, a menu, where you'll find a command. You'll have to realize that it is the command you're looking for. And then you click that command in the menu, and then a dialog box comes up. And usually the dialog box is a lot more complicated than that, right? Then you have to enter things in the various fields. Then you click OK, and then finally your object changes. And that to me is not direct manipulation. Well, there's various ways I could do direct manipulation of this. Well, how can you? Well, can you give me some examples?
You can drag a window of the corner.
So yes, usually when you want to make an object bigger, you just drag the corner and it gets bigger. Now the thing is, it works with rectangles and circles and things and images, but with text usually it doesn't work. So, but it could work. I mean, you could, of course, adjust the point size of the text according to direct interaction. So, okay, so that would be what I would say is the most direct way of doing it. Can you imagine something sort of in between? Yes, that would still be fairly indirect, I think.
Have a shortcut on the keyboard, like Control A to increase or something. I don't know.
Yeah. So how direct is that?
It's between direct and
Yeah, you think it's direct? I didn't say fast. It's fast, I agree, but in terms of the principles of direct manipulation, you know, the key on the keyboard is far away from the thing on the screen, and so I don't think it is much direct. But the point is that you don't always want direct manipulation, and keyboard shortcuts are a good example. For an expert user, you are willing to learn those shortcuts to make things faster. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing to have shortcuts. I'm just saying it's not following those principles.
So by dragging it, zooming in and out, it's not direct manipulation?
Well, if you click here and you drag, yes, this is direct. This is as direct as you can get. Now, another example I have in mind is, you know, in many tools today, you have what they usually call inspectors or property sheets. So if I, well, in fact, here, if I'm in PowerPoint, I can select an object here, and of course I have the handles that we were talking about, but I can also go into this inspector that gives me the font size and select another font size in here. Now, the thing with this inspector is that I didn't have to go through the menu and then find the command and then get the box. The inspector is always here. So this thing here also changes according to which object is selected. So if I'm clicking another object, you know, some things, well, some things change on what is available. So this is sort of a tool that helps me edit the thing that is currently selected. And so the way I would say this is that going through the menu and the dialog box and having to click OK to see the effect
takes time.
That is the most indirect way. And unfortunately, that's what you have to do most often. Using an inspector is more direct, because as soon as I change something here, I see the effect. And then dragging directly the object here is the most direct way. But dragging the object is not always possible. So here I can control a number of things, like the color, like the shadows, like the alignment. And so there are a number of things that you cannot do directly on the object. So that is, I think, the second best choice to do these kind of things. At the same time, this here uses a lot of space on the screen. So that's also a cost. So, you know, and that's always a problem with creating interactive systems. There are always trade-offs. You know, you get some, you lose some. But my point here was that in, I don't know why it starts from the start every time. It didn't used to do that. So my point was that the principles of direct manipulation are often misunderstood, and people think that because they have a graphical interface and things on the screen and they click, it is direct manipulation. But when we talk about direct manipulation, we talk about direct manipulation of the object of interest. We don't talk about direct manipulation of the menu or of the dialog box. Right? These are not, in Schneiderman's sense, the objects of interest. These are interface objects that we have added so the user can do the task. Okay? So that leads to some of the problems we see with direct manipulation. What are the objects of interest? It's a very good question. And in general, what you'll find is that there are some objects of interest that are obvious. If you're doing a text editor, of course, the text you are editing is your object of interest. But then, people who want to edit text, they also want to do some layout. And so if you look at a tool like Word, there is a notion of style. And so what is a style in Word? It's a collection of attributes, the margins, the font, the etc. And you give them a name, it's a style, so I can apply this style to this paragraph, that paragraph, that paragraph. And that saves me time because I don't have for each paragraph to change and the size and the margins and the different attributes. It also means that if I change the style, I say now I want this other font, then all the paragraphs that have this style should change. And so what this means is that in the mental model that we were talking about earlier, that the user is going to make of the system, the notion of style becomes something important. You cannot use Word effectively if you don't know about styles. And many people don't know about style and do terrible things with Word. So I think the style at some point, when you become a more advanced user, becomes part of your mental model and it becomes an object of interest. And if you observe people using Word, at some point you can say, oh, I need to go edit my styles and make the styles the way I want them. So I'm changing my focus from the text itself to the layout, which I manipulate through the styles. And then once I'm done with the styles, I can get back to my other task. So that means that identifying the right objects of interest is not that easy, because you will find many cases where, in order to support all the tasks that you want to support in the system, you need to introduce objects that were not obvious for the user in the beginning. And then we tend to build interfaces that use a lot of these menus, dialog boxes, scroll bars, text entry fields, and all these things. And, you know, is it direct or indirect manipulation? I think they can play a role in making the interaction reasonably direct for things where there is no obvious, you know, handle to pull to make an object bigger. But you should always think about what is the right way and what is meaningful for the user. So, for example, for this thing here, entering the font size, all I've put here in my dialog box is this text entry. So I'm forcing the user to enter a number. Is that a good thing?
No.
You know, if you are a typographer, you probably know exactly the font size you want. And so maybe it is a good thing. But if you are you and me, you know, I want to see how it looks. So I could replace this with a slider. Right? And even better, I can make it so that as I move the slider, the text here grows, so I can see immediately what it's like. And so the question is not whether using this or a slider or a menu or a dialog box is direct or indirect. It's really whether the interaction as a whole is direct or indirect. And so I could make it so here, as I type some values, also the text changes. And in fact, what I would probably do is both have the text input for users who know exactly that they need to have this 24 points because they know, because they're experts, or because they are following instructions that tell them use 24 point in the titles. But I would also put a slider so people can play and experiment by themselves. And argue that if you put a slider here, the slider controls the size as you move it, you have a form of direct interaction. Right? So the way to approach this problem of how to create the right interface for a given problem is by having a rich set of graphical interaction techniques, so that then you can, it's like, you know, playing with Lego. The more Lego you have and the more different shapes you have, the more creative you can be. So what we will do in a moment is to go through these graphical techniques. And in fact, in the context of graphical user interfaces, those techniques, they really rely on three basic, I don't know what to call them, gestures. The first one is pointing, because you spend your time in the system telling it what you want to talk about. So you spend your time pointing at objects. And here I want to focus on feedback. Feedback is always important, even when you do pointing. When I point here, when the cursor is on the border of that object, I can highlight the border, so I know I am the border. And then if I go inside the object, maybe I highlight the inside. Now, in terms of graphics, this is really poorly done, so you need better ways to highlight things. But the point here, and we saw earlier Fitt's law, remember? And as the target gets smaller, the pointing time is higher. So pointing on the border is very high. Now, if I have a feedback that tells me I am on the border, it will reduce errors. It won't make it any easier to point. I still have to get on the right pixel. But I know I'm there, and so it will reduce error. So even for something as simple as pointing, you want to think about what feedback to give to the user. Also, the user, as things highlight, when you move the pointer, it will tell him, oh, I can do something with that object. If it doesn't highlight, if it doesn't react, you know, I will assume that it's dead. There's nothing I can do with it. On the other hand, if things blink all over the place as you move your cursor, it is distracting. So that's where you need to have a visual designer who knows how to make things subtle enough so people perceive them without looking like, you know, you're in Las Vegas. So all the tasks we're going to see are based on a combination of pointing, selection. Once you've pointed the object, you want to tell the system, this is where I want to do something. So selection is essentially a click in our mouse-based interfaces. If we were looking at touch-based interfaces, like on iPhones and iPads and tablets, well, there's more ways of selecting things. But in mouse-based interfaces, essentially selection equals click, or sometimes keyboard. And sometimes combination, you know, shift-click. Control, meta, escape, shift, click, double click. So here, because with the mouse we have such a simple vocabulary, we have only a button to push, then to make the vocabulary richer, we use things like, well, having multiple buttons, so left click versus right click is not the same. We use single versus multiple clicks, so a click is not the same as a double click. And we use modifiers on the keyboard. This is all fairly artificial, right? But that's the way we can make the vocabulary of selection more rich. And the third technique that is used in all graphical interaction techniques is tracking. That is, giving feedback as you move the mouse with the button pressed. We already saw pointing, which is you're not pushing the button on the mouse, you're just moving the cursor. So that gives you some feedback on where you are. But if you're clicking the button and then moving, something different may happen. So in some cases, you are dragging an object, you're moving it. And so, of course, you want the object to move with the cursor. In early systems, there was not enough computing power to do it in real time, so you were only dragging a ghost. And in fact, even on modern system, yesterday I was fighting with PowerPoint to create a poster, and because it was, I don't know if it's because it was big, but the thing was painfully slow, and I wish it would give me a way to just drag the outline rather than painfully trying to drag the whole image and not giving me enough precision. So anyway, dragging, sometimes you drag the ghost or a shadow rather than the real object. Another thing you do typically is reshaping objects, so here enlarging an object. And then there are sometimes where, in fact, the system tracks what you, the trajectory that you're doing. So that's called inking, when you draw, write, or input a trajectory into a system. So that's all we have to build interfaces in terms of input. So one way to describe how interactions work is to use state machines. I think because we're running a bit late, I will leave that to Anastasia next week, because you will use a toolkit on top of Java Swing that lets you program interactions using state machines. So, are you all familiar with finite state automata? These types of drawings? Yes? No? Yes? Yeah? So, this is something that you study in a basic theoretical computer science course. And an automaton is something very simple. You have states, these are the circles here. And when there is this arrow, it means it's a starting state. So when I start, I'm here. And then I have arrows that go out for every possible transition. And in our context here, a transition happens when an event occurs. So down is when I click the button, move is when I move the mouse, and up is when I release the button. So what this says is that what I have the right to do here is when I'm in the starting state, the only thing that counts is clicking the button. So I click the button, I get into that state. And as I go into that state, on this transition, I have an action here. So as I click, I want to remember where I clicked. It's point one, P1. Then I'm in that state. And when I'm in that state, what can happen? Well, my button is pressed, so I can either move
or release.
So if I move, I stay in that state. And I draw a line between P1 and the current position of the mouse. So this will give you what we call a rubber band. So you know it's a line that is attached at one end and follows the cursor at the other. And then when I release, it's the up event. I come back to the starting state. I execute the action done, P1, current, meaning I'm done drawing my line, and now the application should decide what to do with it. And I'm back into the initial state, which means I'm ready to start another interaction. And so what happens is that with these state machines, you can describe every interaction with usually 3, 4, 5 states at most, and maybe a dozen transitions. So this is one I'm not going to go into details. The same basic structure here, down and up, except when I move, I want to only take into account the moving if I've moved enough. So the transition here has what we call a guard. I will only go here if I get a move event and the distance between the point where I clicked and the current point is more than some threshold. So what that means is that if I click, don't move at all and come back, I come back here, it's a simple click. If I press the button, move a little bit, but not enough to go here, that means I stay in that state, and then I go back up, it's a click too. And that's called hysteresis. Hysteresis. It means, you know, I want to move enough to make it sure it's a real move. So if I've moved enough, I'm in that state, and that's what we saw before, I track the move, and then when I go up, so this is the basic machine to combine clicking and dragging in a way that ignores small moves.
What does P1 mean?
P1 is just a variable where you store the current position. Okay. I mean, you know, if you program this, it will might not be that exact syntax, but it's the basic concepts. So what you will, one of the things you will do in the TA sessions is to, in fact, implement some of the techniques that we'll be presenting today with the state machines to see that getting things right is not simple. And, you know, if you didn't do this condition here, people would not be able to click, because it's very hard to press and release without the mouse moving at all. And so people will be extremely frustrated. Right? So to make it intuitive, you have to make it more complex. And that's something that you will see a lot, is what appears simple to users is something that has required a lot of hiding of the complexity and taking care of all the cases so it works in a way that looks simple. So what I'm going to do now is to go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 categories of basic interaction tasks. And the idea is that you should be able to take any graphical user interface and analyze everything you can do in that interface in terms of these tasks. So input tasks is when you enter information in the system that was not already there. Right? So if you're writing an essay, well, you're going to have to type text. Right? Selection tasks are tasks where you are reusing information already in the system, but you have to tell the system which information you're reusing. So it's selecting something inside a set of data. Trigger is triggering tasks, so triggering commands. Navigation is navigating content. Property setting task is setting properties, as we saw in my little examples, and attributes for and arguments for commands. And transformation tasks are tasks that are graphical transformations. So I'll go through these. I'm going to go fairly quickly here because you know all these things because you've used them, right? So the point here is not to tell you what is a text input field, but it's to tell you about this classification. So you know about inputting text through text field that use a keyboard. You know about inputting a single value using a slider. It can be a linear, sometimes it's one you turn. Linear is easier on the screen. But oftentimes you enter a numerical value through a text field, as we saw before. And that's something we'll see again and again, is you can always sort of turn every input task into an input task of simpler values, and boil down to text in the end. The next type of input is when you input a position on the screen. So you have to input positions when, you know, if I'm doing, when I was doing these slides, I had to put this object here, so I need to specify this position. So since you have a pointing device, usually you will use pointing, the x, y position, to say here is where I need it. But sometimes you will do this with sliders. There are drawing editors where you specify the X and Y with sliders or with text input fields. And again, the text input can be useful if you know exactly where you want it. And usually it's for more advanced users. The last input task I'm mentioning here is inputting a pass, where it's the inking I was talking about. You know, if I want to do a freehand drawing, I need to be able to input this. Now, with the mouse, this usually doesn't work very well because, as you may know, the mouse has an acceleration. That means that the mapping between what you do with the mouse and the cursor is not linear. And so if you ever try to write, to do your signature or to write with the mouse, it looks really strange. So usually people would use a tablet and a pen to have more precise input. But in many cases, you need to create input tasks that are specific to your system. So an example here that comes from Word, yes, I believe, is you are in a Word document and you want to create a table. And so to create a table, you have to tell the system how many rows, how many columns. Now, of course, what you could do is bring a dialog box saying how many rows, how many columns, enter two digits, say OK, your table pops up, and then you realize, no, this is not what I wanted. So that's this solution. Now, a better solution, which is the one that is in Word, is that when you click on that button that says insert a table, what you get is a window that shows you a table, and you can drag, and here it tells you it's 4x3 or whatever it is, and if I drag here, the thing will expand. So here they've created a specific input method for entering a table size that is visual, so, you know, I see if it looks like what I want to get. Now, of course, if you, on Thursday we'll talk about programming these things. If you look at the work for the programmer, it's a lot easier to do this than that. Right? Because text fields already exist, buttons exist, you have tools to put this on the screen, and then, you know, it can be done in 5 minutes. Doing this means programming something specific just for this. And it takes more time. And one of the reasons you see tools that are so frustrating for the users is because the developers didn't spend enough time, or the companies didn't spend enough money to do this specific development for their system. And this is especially true for input tasks, because when you input new data in the system, it is very specific to the type of data you're dealing with. So now we get into selection tasks. So selection tasks are probably the ones for which there are the largest set of possibilities, because in fact we spend most of our time selecting things that are already in the computer. Right. So we can reduce the selection tasks to this definition, choosing one or several items within a set. Now, with this definition, you can do a lot of things. You know, this is what Google does, right? Google has the set of pages in the World Wide Web, and the task is selecting the ones you want to see. Now, of course, depending on the size of the set, depending on whether the set has a fixed size or it may change over time, depending on whether you want to select only one object or several, will really change that particular task. So if you consider fairly small sets, by small I mean up to 10, 20, if the set is fixed or doesn't change often, you will tend to use menus, checkboxes, and radio buttons. So a menu is a list of items, and usually you can select only one. Okay? Checkboxes is a way to select multiple items into a set. So for each item, you say, I want it or not. And then radio buttons is exclusive, so it's one within the set. Now this works well for sets, again, that are fixed size because of two things. First, for checkboxes and radio buttons, people do a layout that is usually carefully done, so if it were to grow, it wouldn't work well. For menus, it's because people learn what is in the menu. And so, if things change in the menu, it's very disturbing. So you want... There are exceptions. An exception would be a menu with all the fonts or a menu with all the windows where there is some expectation that it may change. But in general, you try to leave menu as fixed as possible. Now, if we go to variable size sets, things get more complicated. And so typical examples are the scrolling list, which is really sort of like a menu, except because the list can get long, you need to have a way to scroll the list. Another way to select in a variable set is to represent the items in the set with icons, and then you do icon selection. And to select icons, you can do, you know, select one by one. You can shift select to add and remove. You can do a rectangle selection. You can do a lasso selection. So there's many ways to select a set of objects in a group of icons like this. Oops. So here is the multiple selection. So in icons, because you control the layout, you can actually lay out icons so that the rectangle selection will get you what you want. If you are in the list, usually the order in the list is predefined, and so you can do a selection by interval, saying from here to there. But if you want to select multiple disjoint items, it will get, you know, more difficult because you need to do shift clicks. If the list is long and it's scrolling, it means there are things you won't see. So things you have selected but you don't see they are selected. So you're likely to make more errors. So if you are to select multiple items into a list that could be long, it's usually better to have the dual list system here, where you have the list of all possibilities and the list of what you have selected, with arrows to say add to the list or remove from the list. What happens in well-designed system is that, in fact, these things are combined. So, for example, if I'm selecting in the list, I can select by clicking, but I can also use the keyboard to jump to, if the list is sorted in alphabetical order, I can use the keyboard to jump to part of the list, or maybe to filter the list. And so it's important, again, to combine these techniques to help expert users who want to have more powerful ways to access items in the list. Now, I mentioned menus before. There are literally hundreds of papers that have studied menus and that have proposed different types of menus. So I will show you a few ones here, and we'll start with things you probably used to things you probably have never seen. So you probably know the menu bar and pull-down menus. So the menu bar is a fixed menu that is at the top of the window, at the top of the screen, that is horizontal. And usually it contains only pull-down menus that appear when you click on the menu bar at the top. These menus can be hierarchical, so I can have a menu item that leads to another menu. Now here, if you look again, this is an example where making things intuitive for the user can take a lot of work from the developer. If you use hierarchical menus, there are many systems, this is true pretty much on most menus that you find inside web pages. It used to be the case on Windows, I think they finally fixed it, that to get to the submenu you had to move horizontally here very carefully.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you
disappear.
Right. If you move into the next item, then the submenu would disappear. Now, if you did this on a Macintosh from 1984, that I showed on the video yesterday, from day one on the Macintosh, the hierarchical menus, if you go diagonal, you know, I'm here, I see the submenu, I know I want to go to this command. I know the straight line is the shortest path in regular physics, right? So I'm going to go there. It takes a lot of learning and frustration to remember to go horizontally before you go down. And so, you know, on the Macintosh, from day one, they figured this out, and they figured that if you move fast enough, it means you're going to the submenu, so we're not going to remove it under your feet. And it's the kind of thing of getting it right is not easy, but it's really critical. So other menus you know very well are these linear menus that are the pop-up menus that come up usually on the right click. And other menus you know are the fixed palettes. Now, why do I call this menu? Because it's still a set of items and I select one of them by clicking on it. The palette usually stays on the screen. It's not like these that appear just when I need them. So the palette is fixed. And also, usually the palettes use icons rather than text. But conceptually, it's exactly the same thing. Now, the thing is, with these menus, you have, again, this trade-off. Is that the pull-down menu, the nice thing is that it doesn't take up room when I don't need it. On the other hand, each time I need the menu, I need to go there, pull the menu, get to the item. So I'm doing two pointing tasks, one to the menu bar, and then from the menu bar to the item I need. If I have a fixed palette, well, it's already there, so I don't have to bring it on the screen. Plus, usually it's movable, so I can bring it next to where I'm working. Now, who should be doing the decision about what should be a palette and what should be a menu? Well, it can be the designer, but maybe we can do better. So, this came up the first time, I think, in HyperCard on the Macintosh, where they had the tools menu that was detachable. That is, you could take the menu here, and if you clicked on the menu bar and moved quickly, the menu would, in fact, tear off the menu bar, and it became a fixed palette. You could leave it there, and then when you were done, you could close that palette, and of course, the menu was still there in the menu bar. So this is a case where, by just doing something that when you've seen it once, you know you will remember it. You know, the tearing off gesture, it's something very intuitive. I'm not saying you would discover it, but if you see it once, so the first time you use the system, it could show you, you know, here is what you can do, you will remember it. And so it gives you a way to do the trade-off yourself between the space that the fixed palette takes on the screen and the time that you save by going to the palette versus going to the pull-down menu. Now, why don't we have more of these pull-off menus? I don't know. There's no good reasons. Now let's go for something a little bit more exotic. Have you ever seen pie menus? No? Sounds good. They have apple pie menus. So pie menus were invented in something like 86 or 84 or 85 by Don Hopkins. And the idea is very simple, is that the menu, instead of having the items in sequence, vertically or horizontally, like in the menu bar or tool palette, you put them in a circle. Now, why would you do that?
Save time.
Yes. Why would you save time?
Because all the tools are on the same path.
Exactly. So I click here, the menu pops up here, and all the items, by the nice property of a circle, are the same distance from the cursor. Whereas in a linear menu, I have to do a pointing task, so Fitt's law is again at work, and the further I go, the harder it is. And it's even better than that, because in fact, our motor control system is very good at remembering different directions. So there is a variant of pie menus called the marking menus, created by Gordon Kurtenbach in 92, around then. So what it did is first to display the menu is using this display here. The pie menu tends to hide a lot of your screen. And, you know, and usually it's a pop-up that shows up on top of the object you're modifying, so it's not a good idea to hide it. So it is this design that hides less of the screen, but more importantly, it made it possible to select items by doing a quick flick. That is, I click, I move, I release quickly. And if you do this quickly, the menu doesn't even show up. It even works in hierarchical menus. So time menus can be hierarchical. I can go here, and if I pause, a second menu will show up, and I can select in that submenu. So to select something here, I would go like this. This menu shows up. So my cursor would be here, and then I go say down. So I make a gesture like this and like that. So in marking menus, if you know exactly where your item is, you do the gesture, and it will select the item without the menu even showing up. What is extremely nice about this is that it's not like keyboard shortcuts where you have to remember that, you know, Control K is this and Control Z is something else. What happens here is people would discover this just by using it, because as you use the menu, first you have to click, wait for the menu to show up, go there. The next time you click, you wait for the menu, you go there. The third time you do it a bit quickly, and suddenly you realize that it did it, but you didn't see the menu. What it would do is just flash this quickly to show you, you know, this is what I understood. So you have a case where the transition from novice to expert is done on the fly. Just by using the technique, you become an expert. You don't have to do extra learning. The performance of high menus and marking menus has been shown to be 3.5 times that of linear menus. Now, I'm not talking 10%.
So why don't we give them...
You tell me. I have no rational explanation for this. What I know is that Don Hopkins went to work in a game company and had pie menus shows up in the games that were done by this company. And I think that also included things like the Sims, I think, had that. Gordon Kurtenbach went to a company that was called Alias Wavefront, and since then has been acquired by Autodesk. They are the company that makes Maya. Maya is a very big 3D modeling system to do. It's heavily used in the movie industry to do special effects. And they put marking menus in there. But what was interesting is that they were scared. So they say, okay, we keep the regular menus because we don't want our users to be, you know, lost and confused. But you can add your marking menus if you want. And they looked at usage, and every single user who started using the marking menu completely dropped the regular menus. Now, it's a thing where there is no patent, so it's not a question of intellectual property, and you cannot use it without paying, you know, millions of dollars. It's free. Everybody can do it, and it's still unused. And I think one reason is that none of the tools that developers use, you know, whether it's Java Swing or Qt or this thing that we'll talk about next time, implement marking menus as something, you know, as a widget, like they have regular menus. So for a developer, again, if they want to implement it, they have to do it by themselves. And it's not that easy, because doing this gesture recognition right, it takes a little bit of tuning to make it, you know, tolerant enough. But there is a limitation of menus, is that for them to be really efficient, you have to limit the size of the menu to about 8 slices. So here we have 6. You can go to 8, which are, you know, north, south, east, west, and the diagonals. So it's very easy. But, you know, a good menu system anyway shouldn't have more than 7 plus or minus 2 items per menu. So this is not so big a limitation. And in fact, it forces you to think about what should I have in my menu system. And instead of, you know, being lazy and saying, oh, we'll just add that to that menu and that menu, you have to think and to really design your menu system. So this is really an example of something that has been around for literally over 25 years and that is completely ignored. So, trigger tasks. So, trigger tasks are tasks where you tell the system to do something. The most well-known ways of doing this are buttons, and in particular the OK button is always there to say, OK, go, do it. Menus are very often menus of commands, where when you select a command in the menu, you activate that command. But here's a couple other ways to trigger commands in the system. One is a drag and drop, where you, by taking an object and dragging it onto another object, you will trigger a command that depends on both the source and the destination. Now, this is very well known in manipulating icons on the desktop, putting icons into folders and into the trash. And here, the only commands you trigger really are moving or deleting. But there are other examples where you can do drag and drop to do more complex actions. For example, dragging a document onto the icon representing, you know, one of your contacts could send email, for example. So, as I explained briefly yesterday in the when I was presenting iconic interaction, this drag and drop is very powerful because you get this combinatorial explosion that you can have a different command for every source type and every destination type with a command that is very intuitive. Now, of course, you can, you know, use it badly and say, you know, when I drag this onto that, it's going to do this command and it's completely confusing. So probably have to be careful with that as well. Another example that is getting very popular these days with touch enabled devices is gestural input. And what's nice about gestural input is that in one gesture, you specify both what to do and which objects to apply it to. So here's some example. To create shapes in the drawing editor, I can just draw the shape, and it will tell the system that, well, what I want to do is rectangle. It's approximately this size, and I want to create it. With a circling gesture, I can select objects. So by having a gesture that will intersect itself close to where it started, if I recognize this, I can, you know, distinguish this even from a rectangle or a circle, or in some cases people put what's called a pigtail at the end, a little loop at the end, to say, you know, this was a selection gesture. So you can select objects with circling, which is very efficient and intuitive. Moving and copying. So one way to distinguish between move and copy is that for the copy at the end, you can draw a little C, which means I want to take this, put it there, but in fact I want a copy. Deleting, of course, can be striking an object. You say, I don't want this anymore. And you can use gestures in more application-specific ways. So here's, for example, an editor for music partitions, where I can draw the notes, and each mark here both specifies what note it is on the staff, and also whether it's a black or I don't know the names in English, the type of note that it is. So the last example here would be for a spreadsheet, where I could have a gesture like this V sign to say insert a column here. I can select various cells by drawing a line across the cells. And I could even enter formulas that are very frequent, like doing the sum of what I just selected by just drawing a sigma sign here and say enter the sum of these columns. So gestural interaction is very powerful because you can make it intuitive if you choose your gestures carefully. It's very efficient because in one gesture you can specify both the command, some parameters like the size of the rectangle, and the scope, what objects it applies to. There is one big problem with gesture, and do you know what it is? There is one problem with gesture input. Well, there's two problems, there's a big one and a small one. Exactly.
The copy one, it's something you don't intuitively know.
Exactly. In a standard interface, you know, I can go into the menus and see what's there and discover.
There's something new to the user.
What is in the system. With gestures, discovering is very hard. Because there are so many different gestures I could do that, you know, I can try things and can take forever and I will never find it. So there is this problem of discovery of the available features in the system. Another problem is that gestures are by nature ambiguous. You know, I draw this rectangle there, but if I do it faster, at what point will it stop recognizing it's a rectangle? What happens when something is not recognized? Or worse, I draw a gesture for, I want to draw a circle, and instead I draw a selection thing. So what if my gesture is interpreted as a different command than the one I intended? So, very powerful, but it's still not the ultimate solution because there are problems. And that's something you see on smartphones and tablets, is that, you know, the vocabulary of gestures is very small, and you find people all the time trying to, you know, pinch to see, oh, can I enlarge this, and it doesn't work, and not discovering that in a list, for example, if you do a swipe, it will let you delete an item or things like this. So even with very simple gestures, you know, knowing what you're allowed to do where is difficult. So we're moving to navigation tasks. So navigation tasks are necessary when the objects you're visualizing doesn't fit the screen or the window where you're showing it. So the first thing that was invented, and that dates back to the Xerox Star and the work at the park, were scroll bars. So a scroll bar is a device that allows you to control a view with two types of controls, the arrows that make you scroll sort of one step at a time, and so some people call this the elevator or the thumb that allows you to move quickly. Now there is something about scroll bars, which is that you have to change your frame of reference when you think of the scroll bar. If I am in the middle of the document and I want to get to the beginning of the document, right? So here I'm in the middle of the document. If I want to go to the beginning, where do I do?
And drag it to the top.
To the top. Yes. Because in fact, the concept is that this represents the full document. This represents what I'm seeing now. So if I want to go to the top, I have to go up. But what's happening is that when I'm going up in the window, what's happening to the document? If I do it slowly, is it going up, down?
Down.
Down, yeah. So here, I'm moving this up, my document is going down. Now, you don't get confused, I hope. But the number of people do. The first time they use scroll bars, it is not intuitive for everyone. And especially when people have introduced direct scrolling. I think it was Acrobat Reader to have this little hand. And so here, and it's a very compelling thing, you know, I see the document, I'm viewing a PDF document. It cannot edit it anyway. So the only thing I can do when I click on it is really move it. And so if I click, move down, well, the document follows my motion. And so you end up with a system where in the scroll bar you have to go up to go down, and here you have to go down to go down. Now, something I find absolutely fascinating and quite bold is that in the latest version of their operating system, Apple has gotten rid of scroll bars. The scroll bar only shows up when you move the cursor in the window and you start scrolling. And they've reverted scrolling. So if you have a wheel, you have to go up to move the document up. And the fascinating thing is people are confused for a day or two, and then they cannot go back. And I have several, I haven't moved to Lion myself, but other people in the lab have, and they say, yeah, you know, but it becomes second nature. And so this illustrates something I was telling before about learning and the human ability to adapt. You know, scroll bars were introduced. They work the way they should work. Of course, when I move that up, it should go to the beginning of the document. But then when you add a scroll wheel, so is the wheel controlling the scroll bar or is it controlling the document? Well, they made the choice that it would control the scroll bar. So you had to move it up to make the thing scroll down. And then you introduce direct scrolling, and then things, you know, are all over the map. So I think it's interesting to see if this thing that they've done online will be caught up by other platforms. But it's also the case that when you are on devices like the tablets and touch devices, it's only this type of scrolling that you have. I mean, scroll bars, yeah, some apps have scroll bars, but it's not really the way that it works intuitively on the touch surface. Sorry?
It is hard to touch the scroll bar.
Yeah, because if you have a scroll bar, they are too small, so it's not precise and all that. So anyway, so here I was showing that over time scroll bars got more fancy. Here you have something that adds information. For example, you're on page 3, and then the fact that the thumb itself was proportional to the size of the document they're reviewing. And then in some cases you have 2D scroll bars here when you have large documents in both directions. The last thing is something that has been popularized by I guess Google Maps, is this notion of zooming. So another way of navigating is to allow the user to zoom in and out so you can see detail or see an overview. And I'm sure you've used Google Maps, and if you're trying to go from one place to another one that is far away, how do you do it? How do you do it?
I zoom in the place, I find the first place, then yeah. I zoom out.
So you zoom out, because when you zoom out, you have an overview where you can see your target. Then you pan, it's called panning, to go to the target, and then you can zoom into the target and adjust. And in fact, it's an interesting trajectory, because you're going back, you're going up, if you're looking like, you know, you're looking through a camera. Then you're doing a little bit of movement, and then you're going back in. And it's very intuitive. And so there's a whole series of works that have been done on what's called zoomable interfaces, or zoomable user interfaces, ZUIs, where people have really developed this notion of panning and zooming. And if you look at something like Google Maps, you have, when we talk about zooming, it's in fact a semantic zooming. Because as I zoom in, I get more and more details. So it's not just I'm seeing the world from further away. It's according to the scale at which I'm viewing the world, it's giving me some level of detail. And then as I zoom in, I get more detail. And so in the course on pointing and navigation, I will get back to the zoomable interfaces, because there is nice theory behind it and also these trajectories that we were talking about, zooming out, panning, zooming in, which have some interesting mathematical properties. So, briefly, property and parameter specification tasks. So this covers things like dialog boxes and property boxes or inspectors that I talked about briefly. You know about these things. Dialog box, put as many fields as you can to confuse the user. OK button, sometimes you have OK, apply, and you never know exactly what it does. And sometimes these boxes are modal, meaning that while the box is there, I cannot do anything else. And sometimes they're non-modal, so they can stay there until you're done with them. I hate dialog boxes. I think dialog boxes are wrong in 90% of the cases, and you could do without them, because they don't correspond to the way we interact in the world, and they are certainly not consistent with direct manipulation. They introduce not only a spatial decoupling, meaning the object is here and the dialog box is there, and I don't necessarily know what the dialog box is about to modify, but also temporal decoupling, in that I have to set all the parameters in my dialog box, and then I get this one shot of saying OK and crossing fingers that, you know, the right thing happens. And usually it doesn't, and I have to undo, and I get the dialog box again, and I have to start over again. So this is really against all the principles of Schneiderman. It's not permanent representation of the object of interest. The dialog box is there only temporarily. It's not physical action, because usually I have to enter values in text fields. And there is no direct incremental actions with a direct effect on the object of interest. And because people cram everything they can into dialog boxes, then you start seeing things where you have optional parts, or even worse, where you have multiple tabs in a dialog box. So I may make changes in one of the tabs that I forget about when I move to another tab, and so when I do OK, what happens? I don't know. Now, a better solution are these property boxes or inspectors I was talking about, because it's always displayed, so, you know, permanent display of the object of interest. The content will adapt to the object I am selecting. When I select something, I can see the inspector changing accordingly. And I can have direct effect on the object of interest as I move the controls in the inspector. So this is a much better solution, and in 99% of the cases, you could replace dialog boxes by this solution. The problem with this is they may take a lot of space, so that is something that you want to control by letting the user decide which inspectors should be visible, but it's not a big problem to solve. And property boxes were there in Xerox Star, as we saw the other day, I mean yesterday, on the short video. So they have been around for a long time. The final task is a transformation task. And these are all the tasks that you can express in terms of geometrical manipulation. And they're usually handled through handles. So handles to resize, handles to move control points. If you have curves like here, you can move the control points, but also move these secondary control points here for the tangents to the curve. And so in everything that is a drawing editor, you will want to use this type of controls to facilitate the editing. Now, in many cases, you add to this things like snapping or magnetic effects, so that things can align to a grid, or if I move an object close to another one, they can attach to each other. So there's a lot of variations you can add to this, but this is really the direct manipulation at its best, but it only works for things that have a geometrical nature. So either you have to invent a geometrical representation where it makes sense to manipulate a shape to control something, but it doesn't work, of course, for everything. So these were old slides from music editing application to show different types of controls. So I want to spend a little bit of the time we have left to talk about modes. When you create an interface, you are in fact combining modes. And what I call a mode is a state of the interface where the user actions are interpreted consistently and differently than in other modes. So a good example of a mode is in the VI editor, that maybe some of you know, it's a text editor, where you have an insert mode and a command mode. So if I'm in insert mode and I type D, it will insert a D. And if I'm in command mode and I type D, it will delete the character under the cursor. And so you have to switch between the insert mode and the command mode with the escape key. And in old versions of VI, in fact, when I say old, it's until not very long ago, you couldn't tell which mode you were in. The system wouldn't tell you. So you'd have to try. See what happens. Now, this is an example of a bad mode. Yes?
Could you spell that program?
It's called VI.
VI.
It's here.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Oh,
now, if you are in the Emacs text editor, you have modes as well. And the system won't tell you into what mode is it. It is. But the modes are what's sometimes called quasi-modes, they are linked to physical action. So in Emacs, if I type D, it inserts a D. But if I type Control D, it deletes the character. The thing is, to do this, I need to have my little finger on the Control key. So through what? Touch? No? What is the property of touch that we saw this morning that's involved there? To know that I'm pressing the key.
Pressure.
No. Well, pressure, yes, but it's proprioception. Is I know that my finger is in that corner of the keyboard and it's not pushing on the table or something else. So through proprioception, I know I'm pushing the control key.
It can be another key.
Well, it could be another key, but no, good typists know exactly where they are. And so I know that D and Control D are two different modes because my body knows. When I use tool palettes in an editor, there's often a tool palette where I have a select tool, a tool to move things, to move the canvas, tools to create rectangles and lines, tools to enter text. And each tool is a mode, because the same action of clicking and dragging, if I'm in select mode or in rectangle mode, will not do the same thing. But what happens is, if the tool is well made, first, you know the palette here displays which is the current mode, and normally the cursor should change as well. And tool works well because we are used in the real world of having things in our hand that gives us different capabilities. So, you know, whether I have a hammer or a screwdriver or a pen in my hand, you know, I will be able to do different things. So, all of these are modes, but some of them don't work well, some of them work okay, and some of them work well, because they are consistent with our mental models of interacting in the real world. So when you create an interface, you create temporal modes that are activated at some point in time until you activate a different mode. So every time I hit Control in Emacs, I'm changing mode until I release. So this mode exists only while the key is pressed. When I select a tool in my tool palette, I activate that mode until I click another tool, or sometimes the system will decide to change the mode for me. And usually it is surprising. But you can also think of the fact that different areas on the screen behave differently as spatial modes, right? Where the same action performed in different parts of the screen would have different effects. Again, if I click and drag inside the window or in the title bar of the window, it is not going to do the same thing. So this is also a mode, except that it's not a mode you activate in time and then you stop. It's a mode that is linked to an area of the screen. So an interface is always a collection of modes. And the reason I insist on this is because you will find papers in the literature that says modes are bad. You should get rid of modes. You should remove modes in interfaces. This does not make sense. You cannot get rid of modes, or you cannot do anything interesting. And the problem is not to get rid of modes, it's to have modes be intuitive for the user. And so one way of doing it is through properly managed tools. Another way is through these quasi-modes, which are linked to the physical action. And also, in general, with a good conceptual model. So, you know, the modes make sense for the user. It's understandable that if you are in a tool to create a web page, for example, you have a mode where you edit the page and a mode where you test the page. Or you have a mode where you enter things and a mode where you lay out. So, you know, the modes have to make sense also for the user. So what I wanted to do, you have any questions about this? So I wanted to finish with a few examples of things that are the result of research, recent and not so recent, to show that, in fact, what we have on our graphical user interfaces today is very limited compared to the things we could have if the results of research were better used. So I will get back to this first series when we do the course on pointing and navigation. And since we don't have much time, I'm just going to zoom through this, but we'll get back to it. There's been a lot of work trying to make pointing better. Better means faster, fewer errors, etc. And essentially, when you look at the FITS index of difficulty formula here, we know that the further away you point, the longer it takes. You know, the smaller the target, the longer it takes. So many techniques have tried to reduce distance or augment the size of the target. There is one that reduces distance. When I start moving an object, all the possible targets come to it, and so I can then just move here, here, or here, rather than having to go all the way here. So this is called drag and pop. Another thing is people have noticed that when you look at the screen, your eye points before your hand. You look where you're going to go before your hand moves the cursor there. So Shuminzai created the magic pointing. And magic is an acronym that I don't remember at the moment. But it's tracking the eye gaze, where you're looking. And it has the cursor, when you suddenly jump from one side to the other of the screen, the cursor will jump there without you having to move it. It's magic. Now, there are other approaches. Another one is trying to make targets bigger. So MacGuffin did an experiment where the target, when you approach it with the cursor, gets bigger. So it gets easier to click. And he showed that, in fact, what counted was the size at the end, not the size at the beginning. And people said, oh, but look, this is what the Macintosh is doing with the dock. I don't know how familiar you are with the Macintosh, but on the side of the, I have a dock here, and you can see that the icons get bigger. The problem is that that's one instance where Apple blew up, because if you're looking at it carefully, you see that as I move up and down, the icons move the other direction. So in fact, if I look exactly, my icon starts here, stops here, and it's the exact same size that if it were the regular little size. So in the Macintosh dock, even though they expand targets, it doesn't help pointing, because it's not real expansion. I will explain that better when we get to the course. Oh, that was a good targeting. And we'll see, so I will skip this. We'll see something where we actually do some other magic trick, where instead of changing the sizes of the objects on the screen, we change the sizes sort of what we call the motor space, which is on your mouse on the table. So here is an example of a dialog box. It has three buttons: don't save, cancel, and save. Now, most times you will want to click save. So you want to make it easy to click save. So what you see on the screen is this, but what is on your mouse pad is this. So for your mouse, it's a lot easier to get to the save button because it's a lot bigger. It's also a lot harder to get to the don't save because it's dangerous, because it's smaller. And so what's happening is that visually you have this, your mouse moves in that space, and what happens is that when I move my mouse here, as I approach the save button, the cursor is going to rush faster towards it. And when I try to approach this one, it will be hard to catch. Right? And so I'll show you a live demo. And it works in that the size that counts from Fitzlov's perspective is this one in the motor space, not in the visual space. Now there's an extreme case where you know, you could make this button here size 0 and it would be unclickable. And I thought it would be great, you know, on these forms where they tell you, you know, check this to not receive the email. It could be used in a bad way. Right. Making it extremely difficult to click. More menus. There has been, you know, dozens of menus, but a lot of work has been done in trying to combine menu selection with specifying parameters for the command for that menu. So here's an example called flow menus from François Gambrotier, who's, I think he's a former Supedex student, actually. Maybe Central. I don't know.
In the same school, it has
joined together. Oh, now it's joined. Okay, good thing. But anyway, he's living now in the US, so he's having a career there. He's at Cornell right now. Anyway, so he created these menus called flow menus, where first you have this circular thing, as we've seen before, but once you've selected a command here, you can, so if you select the move command, the menu disappears and you start immediately moving the object. So you go on the object, you do a right click, the menu appears, you said, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to zoom it? Do I want to erase it? No, I want to move it. So I go up, and when I come back towards the center, I have effectively selected that entry, and then some nodes I want to move it, so it immediately lets me move it. I don't have to release and then click again and enter a mode. In fact, here I have a mode that is active only for the time of that command. If I had done zoom instead, I would continue to move the mouse to zoom in and out, map to the left to right things. Stuart Pook, who's an Australian who was in France, did a similar thing with control menus, based on the marking menus that we've seen before. So you go zoom, and the system knows you're zoom, and so it's mapping the horizontal movement to zoom in and out. So So the difference between the two is that here you have to get back in the center of the menu to activate the command. Here it's a regular marking menu. We'll see other menu examples in another context. People have created interfaces that use two hands. Based on the empirical observation that most people who use computers have two hands. Which apparently nobody had done before because, you know, we use one mouse. Engelbart, as you recall, had this device where on the right he had the mouse and on the left he had the QWERTY keyboard. So a number of systems have been created. So these are tool glasses. So a tool glass is really a tool palette, but it is transparent and you move it with your left hand or your non-dominant hand. So you imagine a system, and I'll show a video, where you have your right hand on the mouse, your left hand on a, usually a trackball, because it's less precise, but as we saw with Diard's theory on bimanual input, it's not a problem. And so with your left hand, you can move that tool palette over the object of interest. So an example here is a tool palette with colors. So if I want to color this magnificent object here, with my left hand, I move it over. And if I want to color the arm here in this, yellow, greenish yellow, I put it over, and with my right hand, I bring the cursor, and I do what's called a click-through. So in one click, I said I want this color applied to that object. And because I use two hands, I can coordinate my actions. And the studies show that it was 40% faster than using the traditional palette where I pick a color, I click, and I pick another color. And you can use tool glasses for many other things. Here it's used for color, but you can use it to switch tool, you can use it to copy and paste parts of objects. I'll show a video that has lots of examples. So other examples of bimanual tools is interestingly in symmetric bimanual interaction. Here, this is an asymmetric in that the roles of the two hands is different. But there are many tasks where when you want to stretch an object, you use your two hands in a symmetric way. So people have worked on things like reshaping of objects with two hands. And there are other works that use this this notion close to tool glasses, where your left hand brings a tool that then the right hand can use. Now the thing is, if you take any computer today, most people have laptops. On your laptop you have a trackpad. And a lot of people plug in a mouse. You have a bimanual interface. Except that you take Windows, you take macOS, you take Linux. What happens when you plug a mouse on your laptop? The mouse controls the same cursor as your trackpad. And worse than that, if you want this to not happen, it's almost impossible. It's really hardwired into some fairly low-level software. And every time, and I'm one of the people who've worked on bimanual interaction, we had to really do crazy hacks to be able to have two mice or a mouse and a trackball or a mouse and a trackpad be recognized by the system as two independent streams of events. So it's sad because the fact that these decisions have been made and are embedded in the system very deeply means that it's not like pie menus where everybody could implement pie menus or marking menus. Bimanual interaction, it's very hard to implement today because the system doesn't support it. And yet we know that on things like this, it could save you 40% of your time. So I mentioned zoomable user interfaces. So I will get back to this again in the navigation part of the course. And what we will talk about is space scale diagrams that allow you to think of navigation in space, that's horizontally in this diagram, and in scale, which is up and down, as a sort of general framework for this zoomable interfaces. And I'll show examples. People think that this was invented by Google for creating Google Maps. But the first zoomable user interface was built in 1993 by people at New York University. It was not at all designed for navigating maps, but for navigating complex documents where you could zoom in to see details and things like this. So here is the original pad by Ken Perlin and Fox, which was used, for example, for a calendar. So, you know, you're in a document, you see the word calendar, you zoom in onto the calendar, and then it starts revealing the years, and then you can zoom into the year, and you will see the month, etc. And so it was this idea that instead of having a hierarchical system with folders that you double-click and discrete a hierarchy, you have this continuous hierarchy through zooming. And here is an example with the whole novel that is written in this tree where you travel by zooming in to see text inside the tree and then it makes you navigate to another branch and things like this. And I think the last piece for today is dynamic queries. So this was created by a student of Ben Schneiderman, Chris Alberg, created a company after that called Starfire, I think. And he invented this notion of dynamic queries, which is used when you want to query data in a database in a visual way. So you just arrived in Paris and you want to look for a place to live. Just a scenario. What do you do? Well, you probably go into Google or into some sites that have advertising you add and you say, you know, I want a one-room apartment and I want it in that area, and then it gives you a long list and it's very painful. So what Albert did is a system where you would have a control panel here with the various criteria that you're looking at. You could set 2 points on the map where you work and where your significant other works. You could specify the maximum distance you want to be from any of these 2 points. You could specify the number of rooms in the apartment, the price, other things, whether there's a garage, and things like this. And the point is, as you move these sliders, or as you move these choices, the available listings here appear and disappear in real time. And what this means is that you can, you know, you set 2 distances, for example, you set the number of bedrooms, and then typically you're going to look at the cost. And you're going to look that, you know, if you go under this, everything disappears. So, you know, there's no hope to, with those criteria to get something at that price. So just by playing with this animation that you control yourself, you generate through sliding those sliders, you can really get a sense of what is the data. So here, the first example was used on this task of searching for a house. But there were other examples on the film finder here, where you can find by names of actors and things like this, but also the date, the duration of the movie, the style of the movie. And this notion of dynamic query is really very powerful, and it completely changes the way you think of doing a query, waiting for the result, and then refining the query. Google, in a sense, has done a bit of this recently when it displays the search results as you type your query.
Instant search.
It's a little bit of that idea. So that's it for today. So the conclusion I wanted to draw quickly is that user interfaces have not changed very much in 20 years now, close to 30 years. Research has produced many novel techniques. I've just given you very few examples. We'll see more in future classes. And the reason why these inventions don't catch up is usually linked at the not having the right tools to make them available to a larger audience. And so that will link to the course for next Thursday, which will be about user interface toolkits and the tools for creating interfaces, and then into the other part of next Thursday's class about interaction models, where I will talk about a particular model called instrumental interaction. And so that's it for today. Do you have any questions? No?